Thanks. It's fun to be here. Always fun to come back. I guess this is your last event before Thanksgiving, right? So thank you all for being here rather than going off to do shopping. I guess my sacrifice is not as big as Didier's, who's going to give a talk after Thanksgiving on Friday, right? So I wanted to I have the tall order of giving a combined talk for the two workshops, and I hope I managed to hit with something that might be of interest to the two workshops. So I'm going to talk about what kind of interesting phases you can realize if you allow your Hamiltonian to be periodically modulated. So the idea is to use a Hamiltonian that has a time-dependent piece in it, and the relevant spectrum is the Floquet spectrum. And what I will show you is that I can achieve in realistic systems a random hopping model, and also make it a non-topological system into a topological system. Let me acknowledge the people actually did the work. So Yue Cao is my student who just graduated. He worked on the random hopping part of the story. He moved recently to Hong Kong to, he's a potential donor, potential future donor. Nate Lindner is currently a postdoc at Caltech in the IQI. He worked on the topological phases. And Ryan Burnett helped you out. He's currently at JQI. Victor was also a collaborator. Victor Galitsky was my senior collaborator in the topological phases part. All right, so so the idea is, we have a lot of systems, a lot of wave functions that we find interesting, a lot of wave functions that have interesting characteristics, but it's very hard to come up with an experimental Hamiltonian that actually realizes them as ground states. So what I want to do is to try to realize interesting Hamiltonian using temporal modulations. Now, one inspiring example in that is a paper from 2004, from the Harvard group, there was a suggestion how to realize fractional quantum Hall phases in optical lattices using a fluctuating quadrupole electric field. So you put something that's periodically changing in the Hamiltonian, and somehow it averages out into a Hamiltonian that realizes the fractional quantum Hall phase. I think since then, Ian Spielman came up with the synthetic gauge fields, which are more efficient in producing quantum Hall states in optical lattices. But nevertheless, this was the original motivation. So from this motivation, I'll try to construct a Hamiltonian that realizes states that are more of my personal obsession, which are random hopping models in 1D. So Dyson singularity in random hopping systems. And in the second part, if we get there, I will talk about how to use the same tricks to realize two-dimensional topological insulators from systems that are not topologically insulating to begin with. All right, so I will start with the random hopping part. What is Dyson singularity? Show you a nice trick. It's called dynamic localization. Use the same trick by modulating site disorder, and show you that this actually realizes Dyson singularity. Talk briefly about the experimental realization of this. In the second part, I'll give you a small crash course on two-dimensional topological phases, how we can make a trivial system into topological, and what experimental realization we can think of. So stop me with question anytime. Worst case, I won't get to the second part. But the second part is not really part of any workshop here, so it's no big deal. All right, so random hopping models. So if you consider a chain of sites, and say fermions living on these sites, except that the hopping from each site to the next is random. So so here, it's bigger in this bond, a little smaller here, much smaller here. The question is, what state would the fermions here realize? What would be the ground state of this system? And the trick is that whenever you have a strong bond, you can localize the fermion between the two sites into the symmetric state that would have the lowest energy. If there is another fermion coming into this bond, it interferes the nice gain of energy from localizing a fermion here to begin with. You can think about it as a second order perturbation theory that leads to an effective hopping between the nearest neighbors of this localized bond. I don't want to go into details, but you can see how if I follow this logic to its conclusion, what will happen is that we localize fermions between pair of strongly hopping sites. Now this will happen mostly between nearest neighbors, but then once you run out of nearest neighbors, there's still bonds between next nearest neighbors, and you'll form longer bonds in the wave function, and those bonds can become, those shared fermions will be delocalized between two pairs of sites that can be arbitrarily far apart. And this is analog to the random singlet phase in the random Heisenberg model. And you can also think about this once you make this into hardcore bosons, into a spin system. This is just a random XY model, which again realizes the random singlet phase. So singlets form between mostly nearest neighbors, but also further away neighbors and arbitrarily long distance sites. And this would be, there's a caricature of the ground state. Now this is a 1D example of physics that actually occurs in many systems. So whenever you have a random hopping model, you can expect that you have some interesting physics coming out due to this sublattice or chiral symmetry. So in this case, you see that, well, of course, the longer the distance between the sites that participate in this bond, the lower the energy of that bond. And at the lowest energy, you'll get a state that's completely delocalized. So this happens in one dimension, in two dimensions. Now there's also interesting stories that one can tell about these models when you incorporate interactions in two dimensions, and that's following work by Andreas Ludwig and Matt Foster. If you think about bosonic models rather than fermionic models, the fact that you have hopping-only disorder and no on-site disorder might lead to interesting phases like Mott-Glass. I don't know if you can see the bottom of the slides. Yeah. Mott-Glass phases for random bosons, those are incompressible, gapless phases that we expect to arise due to random hopping in addition to interactions, but without chemical potential disorder. All right, so there's some interesting physics that you can find. And let me concentrate now on the one-dimensional example to get more of a feeling of this physics. So if you look at a pure chain, at a just one-dimensional hopping model, nearest neighbor hopping, this is the dispersion, just twice the hopping times cosine of the wave number. If you write a density of state, it looks like this. There's some Van Hove singularities at the edge of the, at the top and bottom of the band. And this is what we're used to. Now, if instead you use random hopping, the density of states changes completely, and you see there's some peak appearing here. This peak corresponds to this delocalized state at the lowest energy near the center of the band. If I focus around the center of the band, I see that this peak remains, and in fact it should follow what we call the Dyson singularity, 1 over E, log cubed E. If I just plot that, it'll look like this. It's a very gentle singularity in the density of states that appears near the center of a band of of any one-dimensional model with random hopping.
When you say random, what kind of distribution are you talking about?
Yeah, it really doesn't matter.
But actually, there are studies, and depending on what is the mean and the variance, you can have a super like a metal insulated transition with.
Right. So this is okay. So this is the work that I was alluding to by Andreas Ludwig and Matt Foster. That's one example, and there are other examples. So once you put in interactions,
in one dimension, without
interaction with hopping, yeah, it doesn't really matter what dispersion you take, so long that you don't have correlations between the various bonds. So there are counterexamples that involve production of, construction of the model from, say, a Fibonacci series, which implies some subtle correlations between the bonds. This actually flows to a different fixed point. However, if you have uncorrelated disorder, it doesn't really matter what distribution you start with. At the lowest energies, you actually recover this Dyson singularity. Random diamond model, Philip Phillips.
Yeah. Where you have the only correlations you have is the fact that you have some sort of.
I'm talking about random hopping, though.
It's random hopping.
Is it the same model, the nearest neighbor hopping?
The only correlation that you have is that there must be some sort of mirror symmetry between, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with his diamond model. We can discuss this later. But as for this specific model, hopping between nearest neighbors, it doesn't really matter. So this was shown by Dyson was the first, Thales. Daniel Fisher solved this, the flow equations that Madhus Gupta and Ravin Bhatt derived in the early 80s to just produce this, regardless of initial conditions of the distribution. And actually, what I showed you before was exact diagonalization on 200 sites. So it wasn't, well, I didn't put any assumptions in there. All right, so these are, this is called the Dyson singularity. It describes the problem that's called the Lifshitz localization, random bonds rather than random on-site energies. If you look at particular wave functions, they're also localized. You look at the wave function from side to side, it has a nice exponential decay. Lambda is the localization length, and the localization length diverges as you reach the center of the band, like log of the distance from the center of the band. So this is not your standard Anderson localization. This is, like I was saying, Lifshitz localization. There's a special state at the center of the band, which is delocalized. So this is a graph describing this. Yeah?
On the 200-site chain, were you able to get the log cube?
I did not do FITS. But I think, so my student did the analysis on like 1,000 sites, and there he can. Yeah. Depending on how much disorder you have and so forth. But I'll show you the FITS later. All right, so this is the background. Now, it would be nice to realize this physics. It has very subtle physics, the localized states at the center of the band. And if you try to realize disorder in lattice models, well, the first guess would be, why don't we look at optical lattices called atoms? And there's some, by now, some nice long history of trying to disorder optical lattices. And usually what you do is you use speckle potential. You just use random, you use light going through a random sieve. It produces some kind of a speckle pattern. That speckle pattern produces a lot of local disorder. And if you think about it, you start with a lattice potential, and now you add the speckle, okay, you make it random, right? So clearly what you do is you definitely change the barriers between bottom of the wells in each place. But you also change the place of the bottom of the wells, the energy level of the bottom of the wells. So in addition to a random hopping term, you also get random chemical potential. This means we have a problem, because Anderson creeps into the problem without being invited, really.
I think that this is not entirely true, because if I take a lattice which is in the blue
side. Which is what?
If I take an optical lattice which is on the actual blue dune side.
Uh-huh.
The atoms will delocalize at the point where the intensity is zero. Mm-hmm. And what you do is this, they can simply weld at different heights.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get the model like what we want.
But I think you still renormalize the energy on site because of the leakage of the wave function to the sides. I mean, you still, because the energy on site is not just this should be construed as the intensity squared. So suppose you have a Hamiltonian potential, a one particle potential that has the same bottom, right? And height of barriers that varies from site to site. The barriers actually still renormalize the energy of the on-site wave function a little bit, doesn't it? This is a strong guy. You just let him in, he'll destroy the entire Lifshitz story. I'm saying this because, you're right, but this is a highly relevant perturbation. So if you allow a little bit of it, it'll take away the singularity. So, but I agree, I mean, it might be that you can get a long way to it. I'll show another trick that seems to be realizing it a little more cleanly. Okay.
Because you lose
part of the yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So if you think about the singularity, right, it's really narrow. It's one of this e log e cubed. It's really narrow and sharp, centered over zero. So it's there because of particle hole symmetry, because chiral sublattice symmetry. Now, as soon as you allow Anderson disorder to come in, chemical potential becomes random from side to side, and you lose this quality of exact particle hole symmetry. And you can think about it as not being able to focus on the center. It just becomes fuzzy. And it becomes fuzzy, it just gets averaged out. So this is what I showed you before. Now with a little bit of Anderson disorder, on-site disorder, it gets completely flattened. Now, the end-to-end average correlations, we started like log of E, become essentially constant as a function of energy, if you look at eigenstate of various energy. If you start with Dyson singularity, what you'll have is Dyson singularity insulator, you'll end up with an Anderson insulator with a constant density of states around the center of the band. If you think about the bosons, which are close to my heart, which are supposed to realize modglass, which is, okay, again, a gapless incompressible state, once you allow some Anderson disorder, they'll turn into a bosglass, which is a compressible gapless state. So all the subtle but nice features, in my opinion, that appear without on-site disorder disappear. And the question is how to bring them out without changing the experiment too much. all right. So the trick actually comes from the idea of dynamic localization. I don't know if this is a good name or a misnomer, but let me describe what I mean by this. This is an old idea that I could trace to Holthaus and Arimondo, and I think others have discussed this as well. If you think of a chain with uniform hopping U, you may ask why I don't use T, which we always use. This is because I need time dependence in a minute, so we'll have to get used to hopping being U. Now, so this Hamiltonian describes hopping of particles from one side to the next. Now, suppose I add a force field that makes this tilted, but also I make it change as a function of time. So that actually describes moving back and forth, like swinging to left and right. Now, if I look at this Hamiltonian and try to solve it, well, I can either do a full flow analysis, which we'll do later, or what I can do is I can try to get rid of this time dependence as much as possible by doing a gauge transformation, just the usual E&M gauge transformation. This is a potential. Let's take the potential away by making a gauge transformation with a generating function whose time derivative is this cosine. Now we'll have to put the gradient into a vector potential. If you choose f, that's just fx sine omega t over omega, you see that the derivative of this is this. You put this function, you put the gradient of this function in the vector potential, it just means that you modify the hopping term like so. So instead of having a swing in your system, what you have is something, it's the same, but it looks more subtle. It's a modification of the hopping with a function that oscillates. But it's an exponent of a function that oscillates. Now this, I don't know if you're, when was the last time you read Ofken, but it's the generating function of the Bessel series. And in particular, once you write this out using this generating function, you see that there's one term which is time independent. And all other terms are harmonics of omega t. Now there's a little bit of black magic here, which we say, well, you could the black magic says, let's average this Hamiltonian now. If we average this Hamiltonian, we get rid of all these parts. And we just get the first part in the expansion, modifying the hopping amplitude of this model. Now there's a good question, why can we average here and not here? Short answer, it works. Long answer, it's probably, you want to use a gauge transformation. I mean, the gauge transformation and the averaging do not commute with each other. And I think the best thing to do is to make a gauge transformation that gets rid of as many terms in the Hamiltonian that do not commute with their with other terms. And I don't know how to specify this more exactly. This is something that's worth looking into, I think. But regardless, you do this trick, you average the Hamiltonian after the gauge transformation, you get a modified hopping.
So what does that mean for observables?
Oh, sorry. So if you believe this averaging, you have an effective model that looks like this. Now you can tune the amplitude of the force you apply or the frequency. It depends on the ratio of the two. And as the ratio grows, what you get is a bandwidth that oscillates as the zeroth Bessel function. So literally what you're doing is by applying this fluctuating potential, you're narrowing the band. You're making the potentials higher. Now, in terms of observables of corrections, you mean, right? Or just
you said the gauge transformation and the averaging doesn't commute. So I want an observable in the original picture. So does measuring the observable commute necessarily with the gauge transformation?
Yeah, I think it is a really good question. So the observable is independent of the gauge, right? The gauge. When you average, you might want to average. Okay, so we average in order to get the spectrum, right? It's possible that if you want another observable, that you want to average in a different gauge. And I don't know the answer as to what gauge is best for which observable. This is a very interesting question.
But I mean, the problem is not rooted in the fact that you have X that is an unbounded operator.
What?
The problem that you have with this non-commutativity is not related to the fact that X is an unbounded operator.
No, this is not an issue. The issue with commuting things, here you have N, here you have opping, these two terms don't commute.
No,
this is not an issue. So the way that people realize this is you have a parabolic potential, parabolic confining potential, and just move it sideways. That's exactly like having this perturbation. This is not an issue, actually.
Except
that
Hamiltonian contains
J0 as
time dependent.
That's absolutely true. So when omega is large, this is true. So this is small. Because when omega is large, you're probing the Bessels at F over omega. When omega is large, J1 of F over omega is proportional to F over omega. Right, so in some sense you're perturbing in F over omega this way. That's one reason. Turns out actually this trick works well into the regime that F over omega is not such a small number. But this is not the problem I want to analyze. The problem that I did analyze, we solved both ways. We did this averaging trick, but we also solved for the exact spectrum. But this is what we're trying to copy in a sense.
This is as long as the thing remains non-interacting, right? As soon as you put some interaction, the whole picture is going to change.
Presumably, yes. Presumably, although I think the averaging will still be good.
But omega may play a problem.
People looked at it with interactions, actually. And what happened is that, well, if I go backwards, so this nice picture of the Bessel zero, instead of going to the zeros of the Bessel zero, actually the interaction gives you a finite bandwidth around these regions. And you can associate the finite bandwidth with actually overlap of particles in the flat band. So it's a very robust effect, actually, surprising. And this was experimented on. I think this is from Arimondo's group in Pisa. What you see here, I think the squares are for a square variation of the sloping potential in time, and the triangular for a sine. The dots, the triangles and the squares are experiments, and the lines are the theoretical prediction. This is basically the bandwidth. This is obtained from time of flight measurements, I think. And seems to fit pretty well. So it's a nice trick. All right. How can I utilize it for my own personal obsession, which is this Lifshitz localization? So in our case, we have hopping, and it seems like there's always this order that creeps in this way. But now you can already see what's coming. Now, if I modulate this as a function of time, then what I can do is, on average, get rid of all shreds of this disorder. I can gauge transformation exactly the same way as I did before, to get all these pieces, which are essentially on-site, they are on-site potential, time-dependent. You can gauge it completely into the vector potential, and you'll get this. So you get exactly the same thing, but instead of the force appearing here, you have the difference in the chemical potential between one side and its neighbor. Yeah, Alec.
Usually when you do unitary transformation, right, there is additional term appearing.
Mm-hmm.
Which involves time derivative.
That's what kills this.
So, we
can do it backwards. Yeah. You design it such that the derivative kills the on-site potential, right? In a single body Schrödinger equation, this would just be a potential. Yeah. And again, if we do the averaging, we get exactly the model we wanted. So a hopping that gets modified by a random term, by a random coefficient, which is the Bessel zero off the distance between the nearest neighbor potential over the frequency. So it seems like, yeah, it seems like this trick kind of works for this. And now let's see what you get if you actually try this. Yes, Tarek.
Saying you make the assumption that we get a single band Hallett model. Are you assuming that the omega is much less than the excitation of the first Bloch band?
Yes.
And all of it will be mixed in?
Yes.
Okay, but this is quite a strong limitation because you got actually U and you got the omega, and you're sort of doing a high frequency expansion.
Right.
And so is there enough time window for to justify these things?
So let me see if I understand correctly. You're concerned about the fact that every time that I will realize this, I will have another Bloch band. Not too far away, depending on the parameters, right? But on the order of another bandwidth away or so, you can probably do it. So we looked at only one band to do this. I think if you have more than one band, the story is not so good. However, we checked how far you can go in terms of... So the only thing that's important is... Let me phrase this a little more precisely. So you want a frequency that's, I think, larger than your bandwidth, smaller than the band gap to the next one. So it seems to me like this you can engineer with a sufficiently tight binding setup. And then, in order to do the expansion, you need the perturbation, the amplitude of the perturbation over the frequency, the amplitude of the force over the frequency to be small. Right? So it's not only the frequency that needs to be large. Or the frequency does not need to be large. What needs to be small is the ratio of the variance of the on-site potential and the frequency.
But if you want to go to the zero, the Bessel function, you have to make this amplitude sufficiently large.
I don't want to go to the zeros of the Bessel function anymore. It's Arimondo and company that wanted to do that. And they managed to do it, actually. So they had enough room. So they managed to make their model in such a way that omega was bigger than bandwidth, smaller than band gap, and they managed to actually probe the zeros of the Bessel function. They managed to localize. I didn't say this, but the reason why dynamical localization is used to describe this is because, right, whenever, so here, this is J effective over J, so U effective in our language over U initially, and they managed to tune it all the way to zero once. Twice in the sinusoidal, only once with the square variation. So they managed to do it, actually. They managed to actually make their atoms just stand in place because the swing was going sufficiently fast that the atoms didn't know where to go. It's kind of neat, actually. But in our case, all we need is a little more subtle. I mean, it's a little less sensitive. What we need is just a random variation here. It doesn't have to be a very high amplitude. So whenever you have a random variation here, sufficiently close to the bend center, you'll see this delocalized state. So we don't need to actually probe the zeros here. Like if we have a 10% variation, 20% variation, we're already good. I have to be honest, there's another concern here, which is this is not producing uncorrelated disorder. Right? The thing that's uncorrelated is the news, the on-site potentials. And it seems like here we produce some correlation between nearest neighbor bonds. So that's another concern, which doesn't seem to be a problem.
So if I may, I think like one could bring them back the concern of the interaction, right? Exactly what Peter was saying. Like,
oh, yeah.
Because if you look at the paper by Ecker and so on, they are saying when you have the interaction, like for example in the Bose-Hallett model, you have to go to large frequency for all these to work.
Sufficiently high frequency for this averaging to work. Well, Marcos, so I would say something else. So what I showed you is a trick to understand why this effect comes about. What I'll show you next is numerics about exactly diagonalizing this problem without the gauge transformation. Comparing, no, without interaction. This is without interactions. But the idea is that using this trick, I think you can still realize the universality class of random hopping models with interactions. Right? This would not be the phase that the system will go to, but the transition between this phase and, say, a metal would be of the same universality class, I'm guessing. And the trick is really, it's really the fact that the average of this term is zero. So you actually don't break particle hole symmetry anymore. You don't break the chiral symmetry anymore. Just because over one cycle, it all averages to zero. So it's not a statistical averaging to zero. It's really a precise averaging to zero over cycle. All right. So I have to be completely honest now, because there are several things that may destroy this story from point of view of averaging, correlation, etc. So what we should really do is just use Floquet theory. If we have a periodically varying Hamiltonian, H naught plus a potential that changes in time in a periodic way, it averages to zero. What I should really look at is the Floquet operator, the evolution operator over a period. It's a unitary operator. It's just the integral over the Hamiltonian. I can construct it if I have a sufficiently finite system, or more like it, my student could construct it with sufficiently finite. They can solve the evolution, produce the unitary, and diagonalize it. If you're curious about this, actually, there are tricks. I think there are papers by Molina et al. That have tricks for perturbation theory that's particularly suitable for Floquet Hamiltonians. You can ask me in private if you're curious. But anyway, instead of energy eigenstates, what we get is quasi-energy eigenstates, namely you diagonalize this unitary operator. What you get is, of course, e to the I epsilon t. You look for this I epsilon t, and what you get is a spectrum for epsilon n that's confined between 0 and omega. Right? You lose your ability to distinguish states more than h bar, more than between a window, in a window of h bar omega. But if omega is bigger than your bandwidth, it's not really a big concern. All right, so this is what we do numerically and precisely without prejudicing our analysis. And this is what we get. So let's compare the averaged Hamiltonian with the correct Hamiltonian. So in the density of states case, when omega is 35, this order with this 10 hopping is 1. This is not the limit that I quoted, Peter. So. But this should give you an idea of how things look. So when omega is 35, it's huge. There's almost no effect. You just get a density of states that reflects. This is 1 over density of states. So instead of getting Van Hove singularities, you need to get the unhappy face. This is what you see. However, when you lower the frequency, you start getting this nice singularity at the center. So again, this is in 1 over. So instead of seeing something diverges, you see something going to 0. And here you can even try to push things to omega equals 3. So you see disorder with over omega. It's actually not a small number anymore. It's pretty large. And you still get a pretty good agreement, actually, between the line, which is reflecting the average Hamiltonian, taking into account only J0, and the Floquet Hamiltonian, which are the triangles. So the singularity is reproduced in both. And Marcos, this will give an indication that regardless of how I do the analysis, cheating, the cheating that goes into averaging, the features of this universality class are still there.
Yeah. Interaction is a different story.
Maybe, but there will be no breaking of the same. I mean, if you manage to make it in such a way that despite interactions, still the on-site potential averages to zero, I think you're okay.
So yeah. Regarding Marcos, so interactions is tend to destroy Anderson localization. So how? Not or not? So.
It's a debate, right? But yes, they tend to.
So would not have. So how much? How robust is your disorder to Anderson localization compared to these two interactions? So in some sense, they cannot help to destroy the.
You mean that if I add interactions, I go even further away from this Anderson.
Yes.
Paradigm. Yeah, but I think the thing that I was trying to bring out was this Dyson singularity. And any amount of Anderson disorder will destroy it. And any amount of anything that breaks the chiral symmetry in the Hamiltonian will destroy it. But we know that it's still there if you take into account interactions with only a random hopping model. So So, yeah, I mean, my guess is that interactions will not be a big deal about this story, but would be worthwhile to check. It's kind of interesting. All right, so this confirms the density of states speculation. So the fact that there are correlations between the bonds doesn't seem to matter. The fact that the averaging is only good for large frequencies or small disorder width over frequency also doesn't seem to matter, surprisingly. So this is fairly robust.
Why does this not symmetric with respect to zero energy?
I thought it was. Oh, you mean here there's like slight asymmetries? Yeah, would a good question. I think this would be attributed to numerical error. But good question. I mean, my feeling is that when Neuer did the actual analysis, he had to chop off things a little bit, and that produces some error.
Because it's 4K. It's 2.
Yeah, this is it's a very good question. I don't know. It might have to do with I don't know. It might have to do with the places where it was plotted. I'm dumbfounded. I need to go back and bring him back from Hong Kong and see what happened. It didn't strike me as asymmetric when I looked at it, but you're right. There is some asymmetry. But you can see that the places where he probed the model are different on the left and right. So if there are some fluctuations locally, that would do the trick. I'll find out. I'll get back to you. It's a little embarrassing, but I don't think it changes the story by much. Given that this should actually be the same with negative and positive energies. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
What's the order of magnitude of omega that's targeting the singularity, the transition between the...
Over here. I think it's around...
So which would be... you have a crossover between the...
It's a question of how much... I think it's a question of really how much resolution you have to measure this here. So it should appear very early on, but I think... you can see the range that you actually probed this. I think you probed it every like 0.01 or 0.02. Right. Let me make a speculation. It might actually be the fact that there are correlations over here that make this asymmetry between left and right. Yeah, I was looking at it with very loving eyes. I saw the Dyson singularity and I declared victory. I think it's the correlations actually over here that's probably doing the trick. So, well, I'll try to pay you about $1,000 to take him away for an hour from Goldman Sachs and make sure that's indeed the case. All right. We can also look at localization length. And again, this is more symmetric, so it's heartening. Again, looking at omega equals 7, you see the nice delocalization at the center of the band. Omega equals 3, you see the same, although you see much more deviation between the Floquet and the time-averaged Hamiltonian. This seems to be panning out okay. Now, there's something interesting here that I can kind of understand, but not in any quantitative way, which is... this is the summary of what we had before. You increase effective disorder by decreasing frequency. So you see more, the localization length decreases. Therefore, one of the localization length increases as omega goes down, which makes sense. The random potential is actually stronger. Dyson singularity stays. Now there's a question, what happens when you take omega below the bandwidth? We can do it. I mean, it's on the computer. It's not so difficult to just change the parameters and ask what the Floquet spectrum is once you take omega smaller than the bandwidth. This is what you get. So now frequency goes, the frequency evolution is actually, it goes down as those graphs become less and less localized. So it seems like as you go to the limit of Anderson disorder, namely omega equals 0, right, you just have Anderson disorder frozen. It should have complete localization. You actually delocalize the system. The Dyson singularity, or some delocalization, stays remarkably all the time. But the localization length of all the energies away from the center of the band actually increases. It kind of makes sense, because if you think about Anderson localization times cosine omega t, there's always some time, no matter how small frequency is, such that all the disorder goes to zero. And then it pops up negatively, right? So at the period of time where the disorder is very small, around cosine omega t equals zero, particles can move relatively freely. So you can think about the dynamics of the wave function, or dynamics of the particles, as being able to travel long distances in the times of the period where the disorder is very small. We try to make this into some kind of quantitative argument that tells us what lambda should be as a function of omega as omega goes to zero, and we failed miserably. I mean, the powers didn't fit, etc. So that's ongoing research. It's kind of interesting to me to see how the limit of delocalized wave functions is obtained as omega going to zero. But so just to summarize what I just said, it seems like the limit omega going to zero is not obtaining Anderson localization. So Anderson localization is not the limit of this problem with omega going to zero. The limit goes somewhere else. The limit goes into a completely delocalized band. All right, any questions so far? So in terms of experimental realization, you can already see what I'm driving towards. If you have your speckle potential, the potential that's induced from an intensity I depends on 1 over the detuning from the resonance. And if you make the detuning actually go between red, blue, in a periodic fashion, say even in a square wave fashion, doesn't really matter what your waveform is, actually. Sinusoidal gave us the nice trick with the Bessels, but actually any symmetric in time modulation that averages to zero will give you the same. And for theoretical studies, it's nice to use this potential, because the evolution operator is just a product of 2 evolution operators. And these systems are sufficiently simple so that you can just analytically study that operator. All right, so if you just modulate the detuning this way, you would realize exactly this model. How to measure the resulting test? Well, I think in principle you can use back spectroscopy to obtain the density of state. It might still be challenging, so we might have moved the challenge from one place to another. Now, to be completely fair, I don't know if this is, I think this is more efficient than just using blue detuned speckle to just change the potential. But I'm not 100% sure. So my feeling is that this is less sensitive. But I haven't tested the 2 methods, one against the other.
How exactly do you intend to sort of modulate detuning as a function of time?
You can either use 2 lasers, go from one to the other. I think this is not an issue, actually. This can be done. But you do have some fine-tuning that you need to do, right? You need to make sure that you detune between two values in such a way that 1 over delta plus and 1 over delta minus are exactly negative of each other. Which means that it's not omega minus omega naught delta is not going from plus to minus. You need to adjust it a little bit, but that adjustment is easy, I think. All right, so this ends the first chapter. So how am I doing on time? I guess it also ends the talk, it seems, because 45 minutes I was told. So any questions so far? Yeah, better.
You jump between actually 2 frequencies here, you would also change the lambda of the optical lattice, but I guess it is just a very minor effect for the frequencies that are
here. Right. So the way I'm imagining this is on top of the optical lattice, no?
Yes.
The speckle.
Change between 2 lasers, I mean.
No, so just the speckle source. So I imagine there's an optical lattice that stays. What? Yeah, so... Right, so the heating issue, I think, would be significant if your frequency is smaller than bandwidth. Then it's not clear what equilibrium situation it'll get. But I think when frequency is bigger than bandwidth, you can't really produce that much heating.
And the other question that I have is this, that if you take a frequency which is higher than the depth of your lattice, for example, you're sort of going to ionize this thing, you know, up to the continuum. But I guess that all of these matrix elements are very small, that's what I sort of remember.
Yeah.
But it has a finite lifetime. Do you have any estimate for the finite lifetime?
No, I was just encouraged to see that the experiment from Pisa actually sees this dynamic localization effect. And since we don't need such high frequencies, no. You're exposing the fact that I'm not a real atomic physicist. I didn't estimate that. But given that the Pisa experiments worked, I think this would be accessible as well, since the range of parameters is actually more suitable. The range of parameters is just broader where this effect gets realized. So, organizer, what should I do? Should I stop here or should I give another 5-10 minutes about the second topic?
You can give 2 minutes.
Okay. So, recent fascination topological phases. Don't mind my misspellings. So first observed topological insulators, cadmium telluride, mercury telluride. So this was following this the proposal by Andrei Benevig and Shuxing Zhang, Taylor Hughes, to take mercury telluride heterostructure, mercury telluride, cadmium telluride heterostructure. If the thickness of the mercury telluride is sufficiently large, you actually turn this into a topological phase where there will be a spin up ed state going this way, spin down ed state going this way. And this was measured by Mollenkampf group. You can see these are various devices. This is the gate voltage, and when your gate voltage is right in the band gap, for one device, for several devices, I guess, they see conductance that's exactly 2E squared over H, indicating 2 chiral modes on the edge. They also measure one which is 0.3E squared over H, just in case we discover the fractional topological insulator sometime in the future. This has not happened yet, but this is the measurement over here. The way that this topological insulator comes about in two dimensions is actually rather easy to explain. So this is a bit of a pedestrian way of saying why it comes about. The Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian of a Dirac cone with a small band gap. So you can always write it as some vector dot Pauli matrices, tau. This vector is a function of momentum, is px times x, py times y, plus a mass in the z direction. That gives you the band gap. And momentum squared appearing here with a coefficient b. Now the topological phase versus the non-topological phase depends on the relative sign of m and b. If m and b have the same sign, you get this dispersion, which is trivial. If m and b have an opposite sign, you get a topological phase, which is this. Can you see the difference? The difference is that this has ed states. So the real difference, actually physically it's m that changes sign, b stays constant, but it doesn't really matter here. The difference is really the following thing. If you follow the direction of D, just make a unit vector out of it, you can plot what it is as a function of momentum, say in the valence band. And you want to see whether there's a TKNN invariant associated with that vector. Namely, you want to see whether this vector wraps around the unit sphere. So in the non-topological phase, here's the caricature. You start off in the center of the Bidon zone. It points to the north. It covers a little bit of the north pole of the n-sphere. You go further away. I'll do this quickly. It covers more and more of the northern hemisphere, but at some point tragedy hits and it has to retreat back to the northern, to the north pole. And as k goes to infinity, because m and b are both positive, d goes on pointing in the positive z direction. So as k goes to infinity, you just go to the North Pole. We didn't cover anything. You can see that if M is positive and B is negative, something else will happen. So we start off with a topological band. M equals 0.2, B equals minus 0.3. As we increase momentum, N pushes more and more to the south. At some point, this thing goes to zero and points in the equator, and as you go to higher momentum and goes to the southern hemisphere. And as we go further and further away in the Brillouin zone from its center, you see that more and more of the unit sphere that this direction describes gets covered. That's a topological invariant in two dimensions that you can have whenever you don't have time reversal symmetry. But now, with this in mind, this is actually the case with the mercury telluride whales. This is how you describe them. Now, with this in mind, there's a question: how can we make a non-topological mercury telluride whale into a topological mercury telluride whale? And here's the trick. So here's a cut of the dispersion. Shine light with a frequency that mixes the two bands. In rotating wave approximation, you just bring them together like so. This is the original dispersion for reference. And now, in the rotating wave approximation, you have band crossings, and you have level crossings. Those will become avoided crossings, like so. And again, we can look at the diagonalization of the Floquet operator over the period. The Floquet operator itself would look like some number plus a vector, a unit vector, dot the Pauli matrices. And now you can ask, what about this vector as a function of momentum? And you can see that this vector does the following thing. Let's look at the valence band. Away from the center of the valence band, you know, the direction of this vector n that appeared in the Hamiltonian is just drawn from the away from the center of the band of the valence band originally. So it's pointing up just as much as here. But as you go towards the center of the band, well, there's a crater here. What is this crater? This crater came from this bottom of the conduction band. And therefore, the n-hat vector that I was following before is pointing down. And if you manage to sew everything together properly, then you will also make sure that in the places where the avoided crossing occurs, where the vector, this vector n, which is now very much changed from the vector n at the place of the crossing, it's going to point on the equator, the same way that usually when you couple two states with the same energy, you get symmetric and anti-symmetric superpositions of the two. If you make sure that that vector n actually points all the way around the equator, you'll get a topological phase. That condition, you see I have tau z here, you can think of a perturbation that's some vector dot the Pauli matrices. That vector had better be contained within the cone that those blue arrows at the point of degeneracy mark. Right? If you follow these arrows around the ring of degeneracy that's obtained when you put these two cones together, it will mark some kind of a cone. You want this vector to point within the cone. If it points outside the cone, you won't get a topological phase. So that's the trick. And again, it's nice to show tricks with rotating wave approximation, averaging, and hand waving, but you gotta do the numerics properly. So now I'm showing you what Nate, this was Nate Lindner's solution of the problem, and he diagonalized the Floquet Hamiltonian in a way that's symmetric, at least with respect to momentum in this case, so no issues here. And you see that you start, what we did is we started with, I went through this quickly, we started with two bands that are described by the Hamiltonian that I showed you before, but instead of px, py, which gives you a Dirac cone, we put sine px, sine py, and here cosine. Okay, so this was the initial band, no ed states, completely trivial. You couple with a tau z, and indeed you produce a topological state with this nice ed states appearing. Yeah, sorry.
Would you end up with an insulator at all then? Because wouldn't you be sort of spraying electrons into the upper band and end up with sort of partially a third upper band?
Good question. So mark this for a second. I'm just wanting to emphasize the fact that, yeah, well, we got to the, at least in the quasi-energies, we got a topological band structure. And now there's a Serang's question. So can we actually say that this will end up being maybe a ground state that's similar to the mercury telluride? I'm not 100% sure, but I think yes. And this is, again, the topic of continuing research. But here's the caricature. So yeah, it was a good introduction to this. So suppose we don't do anything but just turn on the light switch and start shining this light. we start with the Fermi surface that stretches into the effective Floquet conduction band. Right? It covers this crater over, it covers this, I don't have any good descriptive word for this. it's the peak of the bottom of the new conduction band, right? Imagine an electron. So this is describing a Fermi surface, not a Fermi surface, a filled valence band originally. Now suppose you think of an electron over here. Now this electron will, due to small momentum and energy relaxation into phonons in the system, can relax until it reaches here. Here it has a kind of an easy way of going down. And then again, with small momentum and energy relaxation, it will end up in the bottom of the crater. So it seems like the relaxation that's expected here would lead all the electrons from the bottom of the new conduction band into the crater in the valence band, giving us what we want, which is topological insulator. Now we have to remember that this electron is actually sitting here now without the radiation. So it can actually relax back into here. Except that this is a spontaneous emission of a photon. It should have a much smaller frequency of happening. And it's the ratio of that frequency with the frequency of these old processes that should give us how good of an insulator this is. Now the benchmark is not very high, right? The bar is not very high given that we don't have any topological insulators anyway. But that's just a sarcastic way of pushing a very important question aside. So this is what we're interested in right now, which is what would actually be the steady state of this irradiated system. And regardless of the steady state, you should be able to see those S states. And there's another question that I won't wait until it's asked. I'll just say what it is. When you look at those Ed states, they're really Ed states in a Floquet Hamiltonian, right? So they're Ed states of a wave function at a given time in the cycle. It's localized near the edge for a given time in the cycle. Is it always localized near the edge throughout the entire cycle of one radiation period? So we looked at that again from the numerics that Nate did, and the answer is yes, it actually hardly moves. Meaning the wave function is nearly constant. These are really nice localized states once you shine in the radiation on. And now, upshot, can we do this realistically? So let's take the cadmium-mercury telluride heterostructures, shine light on them. Light has magnetic field, has electric field. First instinct is to use the magnetic field from Zeeman coupling, right? So this cadmium telluride actually has four relevant bands. We're looking at just two of them, the other two are time reversed. Those two bands that are relevant have, right, when I have this Pauli matrix here, it actually means that it couples two bands. Those two bands have spin 3/2, spin 1/2. You can use Zeeman coupling this way. If you do that, you will manage to produce the state we want, but you'll have a gap that's of the order, so for a field that's 10 millitesla, which is already big, it will produce 0.1 Kelvin. Not great. Actually, there's some kind of a magic that's at play here. If you use the electric field of the light, you actually get a linear Stark effect. This is because when you look at the potential induced by an electric field, it's E times R, which is E times d decay. Now, when you calculate matrix elements of that near a nearly missed Dirac cone, this is highly singular. So if our device is such that it's non-topological, but on the verge of becoming topological, namely instead of being 60 angstrom thick, it's 58 angstrom thick, actually the effect is huge. So if you put an electric field that's 1 volt per meter, which is very doable for terahertz radiation, you'll get already a gap, which is 10 Kelvin. So the gap is determined by the intensity of the effective potential in the Hamiltonian. Now, it was very hard for me to understand the quantities that are at play when you look at the electric field of radiation. So I checked in Wikipedia and I compared this to the fields in the microwave. That seems to be something that's easy to produce. The fields of a microwave, I think, are 1,000,000 volts per meter. The frequency range is not that far. So in terms of frequency, in terms of amplitude, this is very small. All right, so this is all I wanted to tell you about the Floquet topological insulator. And here's a summary of what I said. So periodically modulated systems could be used to stabilize unique quantum states. I gave you two examples. Modulated speckle potential might give us Lifshitz localization. And you may be able to use terahertz radiation to produce kind of an on-demand topological insulator in a device that could be either non-topological or topological. There are a lot of questions that are still open. So we're doing something very non-equilibrium to the Hamiltonian. What price do we pay? We probably pay a dear price of having heating. We need to shuttle heat off. Whether it actually kills the device or not, I think not, but this is what we're looking at now. So thanks very much. Ah, time reversal symmetry here is a very interesting thing. So in order to have so time reversal symmetry gets the following meaning. So you look at the Hamiltonian and you choose a time around which you do time reversal. Right? And if there exists a time such that once you change time relative to that time, so let's say T0, you take T minus T0 into T0 minus T. If the time evolution remains the same under this transformation, then that's time reversal. So that would give you time reversal at the level of the unitary that evolves from 0 to T.
So about the first part of your talk, so let me just ask you if I understand things correctly. So you have a basically hopping disorder and on-site disorder, and you're trying to get rid of on-site disorder.
Correct.
But then you have the capability of switching the site of this on-site disorder from positive to negative, right?
Correct.
So then, I mean, can you just break your evolution into Trotter pieces where it's positive and negative, and so it just cancels? Is that roughly?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I made this comment of saying that square wave evolution, square wave modulation, or square wave envelope for the modulating part of the Hamiltonian is kind of neat, because what happens is that your evolution operator breaks into, basically, it's not even a Trotter product, just a product of the evolution from 0 to T over 2 and from T over 2 to T. And then if the Hamiltonian is sufficiently simple, and you can describe it with Pauli matrices, this becomes just a product of two operators, with some pieces in the second operator being negative, where they are positive in the first. And what you get is basically that the Floquet effect is deduced from a bunch of commutators.
I guess you do steps, then you have to be careful about your band.
Exactly. So when I showed you solutions that are numerical, what we did is really trotterized and analytically derived the operator and then diagonalized it.
Right.
So, can you use this method to produce something equivalent to three-dimensional topological insulator?
That's the question. So, three-dimensional topological, we're thinking about it as we speak. Well, not right now, but yeah. When I go back to my office, that I'll open my notebook and think about it again. So three dimensions, it's probably possible. So if you look at the paper that describes the second part of the talk, you see that there's a geometric condition. The geometric condition is, like I said, that the vector that comes with the modulation has to be contained within the cone of the directors at the degeneracy. Now, if you take a three-dimensional band that's close to being a Dirac cone, say, I think antimony selenide is not a topological insulator, but it's kind of close, so that's a good candidate system. You make a modulation that brings the conduction band and the valence band together. You get a sphere of overlap. And now so this simple condition goes away, and you have to have another condition. So it turns out that what you want is you want a perturbation that does not break SO3, that does not break a direction in order to get this. And it's hard to think about whether light can do it. It might be that several beams of light can do it, but then you run into the problem that you break time reversal. So we're still grappling with this. Seems like it's possible. It may depend on details of the band structure. Like it might be that if your band structure is such that the Dirac Ning the Dirac cone, the tau x tau y coefficients are not just px py, but px plus px cubed, py plus py cubed. You can use the cubic part to actually generate something that looks.
Yeah, but I have a kind of philosophical issue, because in some sense the way you're doing, you're sort of adding two terms, you're constructing a weak topological insulator in some sense, because you're adding the winding from the lower band and the winding from the upper band. And
no, that was the two-dimensional story. In three dimensions, we want to produce a strong topological insulator.
Exactly. So
if you do something trivial, you'll get a weak topological insulator.
Yeah, but
then you'll get only two indices between
signs. These
invariants
don't work, right?
What?
These invariants, they don't work. You have to use different invariants. It's 3D.
That's right. And we look at these invariants, and those invariants that we try to shift into the non-topological term. But, you know, can try it out, and you know, maybe we'll do it wrong. But so far, I mean, if you use the same tricks as is, what you'll turn is you'll turn a non-topological insulator into a weak topological insulator, but not into a strong one. It will be two indices. So if you just do the straightforward thing, you get two indices to change sign, but not one.
All right, let's stop the lecture here.
Thank you.